is our society can face, which is a complete lie, and which will just destroy first the life of those people, and then, of course, the society as a whole. So, I mean, the only solution to come over this situation is to actually to welcome the people and to behave, well, to behave with care. But this, at the moment, sadly, our governments are not ready.
Nicolai Posner, we want to thank you for being with us with the French humanitarian group Utopia 56. And we end today's show with condolences for our dear co-host at Democracy Now! Nermeen Sheikh on the death of her khala, her aunt, Parveen Sharvani, in Pakistan. All the best to you and your family, Nermeen. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkdine, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Magera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Oregon sets a new record for daily COVID-19 cases. A jury finds Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes guilty on multiple fraud charges. And prosecutors drop a groping charge against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 4th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon set a record on Tuesday for COVID-19 cases reported in a single day, at 4,540 confirmed or presumed infections, with nearly half from the Portland metro area. According to the Oregon Health Authority, that's the highest number of new cases in one day since the beginning of the pandemic. The state has had more than 435,000 cases in total since the start of the pandemic. More than 9,700 new cases were reported from the holiday weekend alone. OHA attributed the spike in new cases to the Omicron variant, which has led to an increase in new cases across the world in recent weeks. Oregon health officials also reported that 18.2% of COVID-19 tests administered over the long weekend were positive for the virus, the highest positivity rate seen in the state so far. The sharp case surge prompted by the Omicron variant has not yet produced a similar uptick in the number of hospitalized Oregonians, although the number of patients in Oregon hospitals with COVID-19 continues to increase. OHA reported 510 people were hospitalized statewide as of Tuesday, including 111 patients in intensive care units. That's still half the number of hospitalized patients as during the previous peak. The state also reported 44 new deaths on Tuesday, raising the state's death toll to 5,666 people. The Oregon Health Authority, along with the Oregon Department of Education, are warning of rapid COVID-19 transmission among children due to school activities. Oregon education and health leaders say schools should pause extracurricular activities or ensure use of masks, testing, and other mitigating measures. They say if schools continue to host extracurricular activities, they should expect rapid transmission of COVID-19 that could prevent students from being able to attend class in person due to isolation and quarantine periods. The message from the Oregon Department of Education and health officials comes as schools across the state begin their new term and the Omicron variant continues to spread. Oregon Department of Education Director Colt Gill said, quote, "It's all about trying to continue to ensure that our students can attend school in person every day," end quote. Gill said that includes schools continuing to enforce mitigation efforts they have already been using, including wearing face coverings, following physical distancing guidelines, frequent hand washing, and use of ventilation systems. The new advisory also encouraged schools in the state to implement free COVID-19 testing programs. The agencies recommend schools and organizations either pause extracurricular activities or ensure they follow specific COVID-19 safety protocols, including wearing masks. Oregon voters could place limits on campaign financing if one of a number of measures gets onto the ballot this year. The state is one of only a few that don't place any limits on how much people or entities can contribute to elections. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Oregon is among a handful of states without limits on how much people or entities can contribute to election campaigns. That could change this year. So far, six proposals have been introduced. Jason Kafori is with Honest Elections Oregon, which is behind three of the potential ballot measures limiting campaign finance donations. He says money is set to play a big role in the 2022 election, illustrating the need for reining in its influence.
That's what's led millionaires and billionaires to give six, seven-figure checks to candidates here, with huge amounts of money going into our governor's race, to have on the ballot an opportunity for Oregon voters to say, no, we want to limit what people can give to politicians.
In 2020, Oregon voters passed a constitutional amendment allowing campaign finance limits. Groups supporting finance limits tried to work out a single measure to support last year, but ran out of time as the need to start collecting signatures approached. Some of Oregon's largest unions are concerned that penalties in the first three measures are too strict. Kafori says his group is using polling to determine which of the three measures they've introduced is most popular. All of the proposals contain financing limits and donor disclosure requirements for certain dark money campaigns. He says one of the measures also includes an incentive for candidates only to take small donations from the public.
The third piece is a public funding, a small donor matching program, which allows smaller candidates to raise low dollar contributions and have them matched by taxpayer dollars to be able to run effective campaigns.
To qualify for the ballot in November, the measures must submit about 112,000 signatures by July 8th, which could be challenging during a pandemic. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Communities of color in Washington state are pushing back on the state's new voting map. The 14th and 15th legislative districts are a point of contention for Latino and indigenous communities in the region. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Challenges linger over the Washington State Redistricting Commission's recently approved legislative map. Redistricting Justice for Washington represents communities of color and other underrepresented groups. It's raising concerns about how the 14th and 15th districts were split in Yakima County. Andrew Hong with the organization says the line splits the Yakima Reservation from the 15th district, where the majority of Yakima County's Latino population is located.
There's been overwhelming community testimony throughout this process explicitly naming that the Yakima Nation should be kept intact with the Yakima Valley, given their long history of shared organizing, interests, political priorities, economy, agriculture.
Commissioners noted these district lines were particularly hard to draw because of the competing issues at hand. Earlier this month, the Washington State Supreme Court approved the commission's maps despite the fact that it missed its November 15th deadline, with members making some last-minute decisions behind closed doors. Hong says his group approves of other voting map decisions, such as those in South Seattle. He says their priority is to have majority-minority population districts so that communities of color are ensured representation in the legislature.
We wanted to maximize the number of districts where people of color are the majority of eligible voters, so majority-minority by citizen voting age population districts. And we were happy to see that the commission did use that figure.
But Hong notes district lines in the Yakima region remain a thorny subject. He says redistricting justice for Washington could take legal action based on the Voting Rights Act to challenge the legislative map.
The legislature has the authority to alter the commission's maps by up to 2% before approving them, so we want to see how that plays out.
Two-thirds of lawmakers have to approve any alterations made to the maps. The legislature will have 30 days to approve the commission's legislative and congressional plans once it's submitted to them. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
With their eye on Texas and other GOP-led states, Democrats plan to vote on a change to filibuster rules prior to January 17th in an effort to pass voting rights legislation. The move comes a month after the U.S. Department of Justice sued Texas, arguing the state's new redistricting maps deny and dilute votes from people of color. Roz Brown has more on the story.
Leaders in the U.S. Senate have announced plans to vote this month on a change to filibuster rules, hoping to pass voting rights legislation they say is needed to protect democracy. Democrats charge that since the 2020 election, Republican-led states such as Texas have passed laws that could subvert future elections. Last month, the Department of Justice sued over the state's new redistricting maps, arguing they deny Black and Latino voters an equal opportunity to participate in the voting process and elect representatives of their choice. Richard Pineda is a communications professor at the University of Texas at El Paso.
If you can isolate a population that you think is going to lean one way politically, and it also overlaps with ethnic identity markers, then I think you see a really tremendous impact.
The election and voting rights package is stalled in the evenly split 50-50 Senate, and Democrats have been unable to agree over potential rule changes to reduce the necessary 60-vote threshold. Texas's explosive population growth in the past 10 years meant it gained two new congressional districts based on census data. The state grew by nearly 4 million residents, with an estimated 95% of that growth due to Latino and Black residents. Admitting that elections have consequences, Pineda nonetheless calls the gerrymandering in Texas outlandish.
At a minimum, it means your representatives are stretched pretty thin, but in a more nefarious way, it suggests that the political system is out to leverage partisanship over representation.
At the same time, Pineda is skeptical the DOJ lawsuit against Texas will have a definitive impact. He says the longer the legal fight is drawn out, the harder it will become to change the already approved maps. He adds, however, that the lawsuit could delay Texas's March 1st primary election. I'm Roz Brown reporting.
Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes was convicted on Monday of 4 federal charges of fraud for exaggerating to investors what her blood testing company's machines could do, how much money the company could earn, and how widely the machines were being used. 37-year-old Holmes was the force behind marketing a modernized blood test, advertised as a cheap finger prick that could run any commercially available blood diagnostic on a device about the size of a large PC at lower cost than conventional labs. The Wall Street Journal reported in 2015 that Theranos devices were inaccurate, and the company was secretly resorting to running blood tests at other labs on other companies' machines. The jury deliberated for 7 days, unable to reach a unanimous verdict on 3 of the charges. They found Holmes guilty of 4 of 11 charges. Holmes faces up to 20 years in prison per charge, likely to be served concurrently. As a first-time offender, Holmes is unlikely to face the full term. She could also be fined and required to pay restitution to her former investors. A sentencing date could be set at a hearing as early as next week. Of the 11 charges, Holmes was acquitted on all that related to defrauding patients and 1 count of conspiracy. The jury remained deadlocked on 3 counts of defrauding investors. In total, Holmes was found guilty of defrauding investors of nearly $145 million. The Albany County District Attorney's Office in New York said Tuesday that it is moving to dismiss a misdemeanor charge of forcible touching against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo was scheduled to appear in court on Friday. D.A. David Soares said in a statement, quote, "While we found the complainant in this case cooperative and credible, after review of all the available evidence, we have concluded that we cannot meet our burden at trial," end quote. Cuomo was accused of forcible touching last October. The complaint alleged he placed his hand under a woman's blouse during an encounter at the governor's mansion in 2020. Cuomo denied the allegations, which were made by an executive assistant in his office, Brittany Camiso, who went public with her identity after the complaint was issued. Camiso was one of 11 women who outlined allegations of harassment against the governor in a blistering report by the state attorney general's office. The report led to Cuomo's resignation in August. Camiso's allegations were the most serious against Cuomo, who could have faced up to a year in jail had he been convicted. The decision comes on the heels of similar announcements involving allegations by two other accusers by district attorneys in Nassau and Westchester counties. Cuomo was not charged in either of those cases. Marion Wang, an attorney who represents two other accusers, said her clients were disappointed but not surprised by the DA's decision. Wang added, quote, "Unfortunately, our penal laws and system frequently do not properly punish the acts of so many abusive men in power," end quote. Vacation rental company Airbnb announced on Tuesday that hosts in Oregon will soon be blocked from initially seeing the full name of guests in an experiment aimed at curbing discrimination against Black travelers. For 2 years, starting January 31st, vacation landlords in Oregon offering rentals through Airbnb will be able to see only the first initial of prospective guests. The guests' full names will appear only after the booking is confirmed. Airbnb spokesperson Liz DeBold-Fusco said the policy change is an experiment in one state. DeBold-Fusco said, quote, "Given that the impact of this change is unknown, the implementation will be limited to Oregon," end quote. The change is linked to the 2019 settlement of a lawsuit by three Black plaintiffs who said the site allowed rental owners to discriminate against customers based on race. Airbnb added, quote, "As part of our ongoing work, we will take any learnings from this process and use them to inform future efforts to fight bias," end quote. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for It Did Happen Here, a historical short-form documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together in Portland against racist white skinheads in the 1980s and 90s. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 41 degrees. Today in history, in 1999, the euro debuts as a currency in Europe, as 11 nations adopted a single currency, now the official currency of 19 members of the European Union, as well as the nations of Kosovo and Montenegro. The euro's introduction had a profound effect on the global economy and was a watershed moment in the continent's history. The quote of the day is from American politician, conservationist, and writer Theodore Roosevelt, who served as the 26th president of the United States. Roosevelt said, quote, "Believe you can, and you're halfway there." The Senate's first votes of 2022 are rescheduled by bad weather. President Joe Biden meets with ranchers about the meatpacking industry, and the FDA backs Pfizer's booster for 12 to 15-year-olds. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
If there is no further business to come before the Senate, I ask that it stand adjourned under the previous order.
The Senate stands in adjournment until 10 a.m. tomorrow.
The Senate held its first formal session of 2022 Monday, but a winter storm and resulting travel disruptions put the chamber's planned votes on hold. While lawmakers figure out their travel schedules, the first Senate votes of the year have been pushed to Tuesday. The snowy conditions didn't keep everyone away, as Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont rose to commend the Washington, D.C. cleanup crews for their work clearing and maintaining roads.
I applaud those who are doing that because it is not an easy job.
Meanwhile, in Congress's other chamber, Representative Devin Nunes of California finalized his resignation. The Republican is leaving to become chief executive of former President Donald Trump's new media company. Nunes's exit had little fanfare as he submitted a brief letter tendering his resignation.
It has been the honor of my life to represent the people of California's San Joaquin Valley for the last 19 years. Please let me know how I can be of help during this transition. Signed sincerely, Devin Nunes, Member of Congress.
Democratic leaders say they haven't given up hope on passing voting rights legislation and President Joe Biden's Build Back Better framework. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told Republicans he'll put filibuster reform to a vote by January 17th unless GOP lawmakers endorse the voting rights bill. At the White House, President Joe Biden met with farmers and ranchers Monday to discuss issues facing the meat industry. President Biden says his administration is prioritizing increasing competition in the industry to keep prices competitive.
Four big corporations control more than half the markets in beef, pork, and poultry.
The president's plan to increase competition in the sector would, among other things, set aside $1 billion to expand independent processing operations. The Food and Drug Administration has authorized Pfizer COVID-19 boosters for teens between the ages of 12 and 15. The move comes as Omicron continues to surge across the U.S., forcing many school districts to delay their return to in-person classes. Peter Marks with the FDA's Center for Biologics Research and Evaluation says the boosters will help prevent community spread among those students as they return to class.
In particular, we're most interested in making sure that we prevent serious outcomes such as hospitalization and death, which granted, though uncommon in 12 to 15-year-olds, can occur.
Former Senator Harry Reid, who died last month, will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda next week. The Nevada Democrat served five terms in the Senate, including an eight-year stint as majority leader during most of the Obama administration. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
More than 60 people face evictions by the Nooksack Nation in an ongoing disenrollment fight. A federal judge sides with law enforcement officials in Dakota Access Pipeline brutality complaints, and the Omicron variant is triggering calls for renewed precautions among tribes. With that story and more, it's Art Hughes with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes in for Antonio Gonzalez. A federal judge is siding with local law enforcement officials in a series of lawsuits brought by defendants, arguing the officials used excessive force during clashes over the Dakota Access Pipeline construction in 2016. U.S. District Judge Daniel Traynor writes that there is, quote, undisputed and irrefutable evidence that, in his words, could only lead a reasonable juror to conclude the officer's conduct in this case was objectively reasonable. Lawyers for the plaintiffs in the case expressed their disappointment with the judge's ruling. The Bismarck Tribune reports attorney Janine Hoff said the decision is an example of how judges use qualified immunity to let law enforcement off the hook for even the most extreme brutality. The Nooksack tribe in Washington state is in the process of evicting some 63 people from tribal housing. They are part of the more than 300 people involved in a bitter disenrollment battle with the tribe. Many of those facing eviction are children and elders. The Seattle Times reports the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is looking into whether the tribe is violating the Indian Civil Rights Act. A statement by the Bureau of Indian Affairs acknowledged that the evictions could have serious effects on the individual's health and well-being, but also says the agency respects tribal sovereignty and supports self-determination. The Bureau is asking the tribe to delay the evictions for 30 days. The tribe says the evictions are the result of disenrolling those who cannot prove their tribal lineage and were incorrectly added to the member rolls in the 1980s. A regional chief with Canada's Assembly of First Nations is thanking the government for money set aside for First Nations child welfare. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, she says there is still a long way to go.
The money will go to First Nations children and their parents or grandparents. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruled 5 years ago that Ottawa had underfunded the child welfare system on reserves. The government was ordered to pay up to $40,000 for each First Nations child that was unnecessarily placed in foster care. Native child welfare advocates in the Canadian government have been negotiating since November after Ottawa appealed the compensation order. That decision was criticized as being unhelpful toward the goal of reconciliation. Negan Sinclair is an associate professor of Native Studies at the University of Manitoba.
It's only the beginning part of this journey, though, because of that $40 billion, a portion of it will be to correct the harms that have been creating these conditions.
That $40 billion was announced in mid-December as money the government set aside to compensate those harmed by the child welfare system, as well as for reforming that system. The Canadian government is expected to provide more details about the agreement this week. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Navajo Nation in Arizona reported its first known case of the Omicron coronavirus variant. In a written statement, President Jonathan Nez said it's not a time to panic, but rather another sign to step up precautions and prevention efforts. He reiterated his message that the best defense against the pandemic is for people to get fully vaccinated, including a booster shot. A study by the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services shows COVID-19 was the leading cause of death for Native Americans in that state. The Great Falls Tribune reports COVID is responsible for a quarter of the more than 1,000 Native American deaths in Montana in 2020. The total number is above the average 676 deaths a year from the 5 years prior. A previous report found that in 9 months in 2020, Native Americans comprised almost a third of the state's COVID deaths, even though they make up less than 7% of the population. Health officials all over the country are warning about the rapidly spreading variant of the virus that has disrupted daily life for the past 2 years. Reuters reports at least 18 states are reporting pandemic case records. A University of Texas study predicts the number of Omicron cases to peak between January 18th and February 3rd, with cases falling off sometime in March. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
Students at Harvard have been pushing the university to stop investing in the fossil fuel industry. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In September, Harvard University announced that it will no longer invest in fossil fuels.
I think we do have to chalk up this win to a huge win for activism, and I've been so inspired by the undergrads that are leading this movement.
John Verghese is a Master of Public Policy student at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's part of a student-led activist group that for 10 years has been pushing the university to divest its endowment from the fossil fuel industry. Student activists have led demonstrations on campus, including sit-ins, marches, and speeches. On one parents' weekend, they even poured molasses on each other to simulate an oil spill. And in 2021, students filed a complaint with the Attorney General of Massachusetts. They argued that Harvard's investment in fossil fuels violates the university's legal responsibilities. Verghese says institutions must stop investing money in the companies driving global warming.
On a moral level, you know, if your house is on fire, why would you stand with the arsonists?
With an endowment valued at more than $50 billion, Harvard is the richest university in the world, and its financial decisions carry enormous influence. So even though Verghese is frustrated by how long it took to get to this step,
I don't think that we can understate the importance of this victory.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Israel has lifted restrictions barring same-sex couples and single men from becoming parents through surrogacy within the country, upholding a Supreme Court ruling to end the ban. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Israel's health ministry announced Tuesday that same-sex couples may use surrogate mothers starting next week. Last July, the Israeli Supreme Court annulled parts of a law banning gay couples from having children through a surrogate. The law was actually expanded to allow single women access, but it still excluded gay couples. The court found the law, quote, disproportionately harms the right to equality and the right to parenthood, end quote. It took 6 months for the ruling to come into effect, to allow for the formation of professional guidelines. Israel's LGBTQ plus community had been pushing for years to be allowed access to surrogacy. The law banned surrogacy for gay couples only within the country, and some citizens traveled abroad to gain access. However, many could not afford the associated costs. Israel differs from its more conservative Arab neighbors in being slightly more tolerant towards LGBTQ plus citizens. Gay Israelis can serve in the military and in parliament, and many well-known performers and artists are openly gay. Even so, religion still plays a major role in government and politics, and same-sex marriages are still illegal. Israeli Health Minister Nitzan Horowitz is openly gay. They recently said, quote, full equality. That is the simple demand, and it is the goal of the LGBT struggle, the long struggle of my community, end quote. The change to the law will also allow surrogacy use for single men and transgender people. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 4th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Jonah Chester, Art Hughes, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland discusses the new Netflix film, Don't Look Up. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now, for it did happen here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
This is Mike Crenshaw, one of your hosts for It Did Happen Here. This episode is personal. Back in the 80s, I was a member of the Minneapolis Baldies, a multiracial crew of anti-racist skinheads that started around 1986. In 2019, I went to Minneapolis to do interviews for a book I'm writing about black skinhead culture. I sat down with some of my old crew to talk about those days. I recorded these interviews in bars and people's apartments and coffee shops as reference notes for myself on my computer. There are also interviews with me in a lot of